Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At last night's State of the Union address, with Dreamers in the audience, Donald Trump equated immigrants with gang members and terrorists. As undocumented immigrants who were invited to attend were about to enter the building, Arizona Republican Representative Paul Gosar asked Capitol Police to arrest them. But with Dreamers surrounding them, Democrats called on Congress to vote on legislation that would permanently protect those who were brought to the United States as children. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants in the U.S. are documented through DACA and temporary protected status. TPS was designed to protect immigrants from countries affected by conflict or natural disasters. The protections of these programs are now scheduled to end in the coming years unless lawmakers work out solutions. So while politicians argue immigrant families are facing very difficult choices, do they have any options besides leaving the country or staying and becoming undocumented? How are communities mobilizing in response? Today, we are joined by three guests who are asking these questions on a daily basis. Today, we're joined by Vanessa Velasco. Vanessa is a TPS recipient from El Salvador who lives with her family in Brentwood. And Vanessa joins us in studio. Hi, Vanessa. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Laura.
Rose. Yes, that's okay. Nice to have you. Well, we have two L's in the studio today. We're also joined by Laura Melgarejo. Laura is a DACA recipient and civic engagement organizer with People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights. And Laura also joins us in studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Larisa Dugan Cadra. She's executive director of the Central American Resource Center here in San Francisco. And Larisa joins us in studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Well, I want to ask you to comment on the State of the Union address last night. As I said, there were Dreamers in the audience. They were invited by Democrats. There were a few undocumented immigrants in the audience, and he equated immigrants with gang members and terrorists. Larisa, you said this is not surprising to you. What was your response to the address?
Well, I think at least with Donald Trump, the one thing we can thank him for is that we get what we see and we get what we hear. He has continued to be consistent in terms of his anti-immigrant, hate, racist, xenophobic speech. Yesterday was no different. He made no comment whatsoever about any of the countless contributions immigrants make to this nation. And the irony of all this is that his mother's an Irish immigrant, his wife is an immigrant, and, you know, we were just listening mostly for what his proposal is. You know, he affirmed what we saw in the report in terms of his carnage and intent to really divide our community, which we're not going to allow that to happen. He equated our community to criminals, and the fact is that, you know, statistically in the U.S., more crimes are committed by U.S.-born individuals than the immigrant population overall. The fact is that the immigrant community contributes billions of dollars to the U.S. economy and on all fronts. The Dreamers, the TPS community, and immigrants overall, the 11-plus million who contribute their hard work, cultural assets, and, you know, vision to this nation. So, you know, we are, our struggle continues. We're steady. We're ready. And our message is really to the community that we cannot succumb to fear, to frustration and anger, that we actually really have to respond from a place of power and not fear. And that, you know, ultimately there's a silver lining in everything. And our job as community-based organizations that work with community, for community, by community, is that we have always made lemonade out of lemons. And the silver lining is that we have more sanctuary cities in the nation than before Donald Trump was elected. Mm. We've had more affirmation by local public officials of our nation's values of inclusion, of equity and justice. And that is an ongoing struggle, not just for immigrants, but for working class people across the U.S.
I should say, since you brought up sanctuary cities, we now have a new interim mayor, Mark Farrell, in San Francisco. And there were a lot of questions about where he stands on sanctuary cities. But he did tweet, I think the second or the third day he was in office, and said, "We live in a sanctuary city and I will protect immigrants."
We're actually very pleased that since the unfortunate passing of Mayor Lee, who was unequivocally very clear about his stance and his commitment to protecting the values of San Francisco and making sure our city is a city for everyone. Former Mayor Breed affirmed that as well. And we were actually really pleased that Mark Farrell, or the current mayor, Mark Farrell, called a meeting with the immigrant community 3 days after he was sworn into office to essentially affirm to us. It was a day after he sent the tweet. He actually consulted with the community in terms of, like, the messaging that we felt was important for our community to hear from our local officials, and that was reflected in his press statement after the meeting with us. So, we're happy. That's just one less battle for us, honestly, is to know that our local elected officials, or that we're in a time in San Francisco where you can no longer be mayor. You can no longer be an elected official if you don't have a strong stance on immigrant rights and continuing those protections for all of our residents. Mm.
Vanessa, what was your reaction to the speech last night?
Well, it was a little sad because he compared all the immigrants with terrorist gang members. And one funny thing is the majority of the people that is fleeing, like I'm from El Salvadorian, is the violence. Mm. That raging violence from the MS-13 is raining to our country. And please don't forget the MS-13 was originated in the United States. They start to deport them, send them over then to rural countries, especially El Salvador wasn't ready to receive them. And this is what one of the biggest calls. You see all the minors, unaccompanied minors at the border.
Can you talk about how this rhetoric affects immigrants when Trump compares immigrants to terrorists, or in this case, M13 gang members?
It just creates a fear. You know, the people, usually your neighbors or when you go on the bus or something, the people start to see you different just because your color or something, because they start to hearing, oh, these people is dangerous. They can do, you know, terrible things. But no, don't forget, this is the people that you see every day when you go to a restaurant and order a pupusa or a burrito or something. This is the people that is in the kitchen preparing your stuff, or when you go and travel for work, the maids that are on the hotels or the card givers. Yeah, it's like, don't forget about that. Don't let this just rhetoric fool just of venom, I will say, because that is not the truth. Mm.
Laura, what would you add?
Well, you know, actually, I was in class last night. Mm. I was studying, trying to get a certification to become a paralegal in the city so that I'm able to better serve my community. Mm. So, I saw some of the clips after. And again, what Larissa, I'm just going to reiterate what Larissa said, all the hate, the discrimination and anti-immigrant sentiment was clear and loud. And I was not surprised. I think that under this administration, we will continue to see that the next 3 years or so. And so I'm not actually, I was not surprised. I was just like, yeah, that's what I was expecting.
Mm. Let's talk. Go ahead.
I think one thing that Larissa. I do, with Donald Trump is not surprising. I mean, the man was elected with that speech, right? But what's concerning is that, as they say, you know, teachers set examples in the classroom for how children in the classroom community should behave. And leaders do the same. Local leaders, state leaders, national leaders. And the U.S. is a global leader. And so essentially what we see is, on one hand, this government basically conceding its leadership role in the globe, and that leadership role could be questioned. That's a separate chapter. Mm. Through dominance in terms of economics and militarization, which is also happening in our countries, which is forcing people to migrate. Mm-hmm. But second, that is really kind of creating this national environment. We know we're polarized, but when polarization results in overt manifestations of hate, of racism and xenophobia, when people get hate mail, hate calls. You know, when you see the comments on news reports about immigrants and the level of hate that just exists within our own communities, and that is like being uncovered, like the lid's been lifted. And so the community doesn't just have to deal with a national leader, a president, basically directly attacking them, attacking us, working class immigrant communities. But you then have to deal with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and with just the public discourse around what the contributions or not are of the migrant community, it's unquestionable. And also, there was no mention yesterday of the Native American community. And so Donald Trump made it sound like this country was just kind of born the day the ships from Europe arrived. And I can't imagine how the Native American community is feeling right now in the country, because there was absolutely nothing mentioned about the Native community in this nation.
Thank you for saying that. My family's Native, and it was infuriating. He talked about arriving to this wilderness and creating this amazing place as if people arrived to an empty land. Mm. But this is very common across the board. But I really appreciate you saying that. I think also your comment about how this changes your everyday relationships with your neighbors, with your coworkers. Can you all talk more about that? Just how this rhetoric has really changed your everyday life, the things people ask you maybe, or just what you're more aware of now.
Well, for us, it's like
Vanessa.
Some of our stories are being, my family stories being, you know, published in a local press. My daughter worked for that press in Brentwood. And it's nice the comfort that people come and ask you, we never thought that you were in that situation. What can we do? But at the same time, you receive, you know, those type of emails or comments on the article that they just, why instead of, because I have three kids, why instead of having kids you don't look for a pathway to citizenship or become legal? It's not that easy. And when you try to explain them, they already, you know, have those ideas of you don't become a legal resident because you do something wrong or something is doesn't add up on the equation or other people. It's not about the welfare. As a TPS beneficiary, we know that we are not allowed of federal help. That's a complete lie. It's nice when you receive the support and, you know, the comfort from neighbors and people that you didn't even know. Like my daughter is part of a gymnastic competitive team, and one of his teammates just come and run out of her, run to her, and I don't want you to leave. I don't want you to. And they just barely interact. And it's like, wow, if you see from other kids that, you know, that kind of compassion. Mm-hmm. And what happened with us, you know, the grown-ups that they're supposed to are being, you know, teaching our kids these things.
Mm. Laura?
I think I want to add that in my everyday work, I have seen a lot of families. This is an issue in which, you know, under this administration, all Latinos are Mexican because that's how they label us. And so when I see my community coming through our doors asking for support or help, we see each other more as one. It doesn't matter where are we coming from. You know, at the end of the day, we're all here trying to achieve the same thing, work really hard, support our families back home, go to school, whatever you're here for. And I feel like since we started with this narrative, when the administration started with this narrative, I have seen more like the solidarity among our communities from El Salvador, from central to south within Mexico, because at the end of the day, we all are under attack. It's not just one particular group from Latino America. It's all of us who look Latinos or who are Latinos who are under attack. And I think that I have seen that solidarity in my community, and that brings me hope. And in my everyday work, those are the things that I look forward in order to stay strong and in order to be able to continue to support my community.
Hmm. Larissa, what else are you hearing from immigrants in terms of just how they're being affected by the rhetoric and in their everyday lives?
Well, I mean, one thing, I think we've done a good job locally. And again, we're in a very unique geographic area in the United States. There's many places across the nation that don't have elected officials defending the value of family unity and inclusion. You also have states where the police are being given carte blanche to behave and act and do the work of the federal government in draining their own local resources for that. So we're in a blessed place, and the fact that the city, the community organizations, and the beneficiaries, the community itself, have been able to come together, coalesce, like really fortify our resilience, it makes a huge difference. So what we're seeing is people are coming out to get their legal consultations to screen for potential programs they may already qualify for. We are on renewal mode, both for DACA and for TPS. So we want to make sure nobody, there's a lot, the main challenge that we've had is that people are afraid, or they're not 100% sure if they should be renewing or not, because they feel that if they renew, the feds will have their information. And what we're saying to our community is the feds already have your information. Mm. And it's better for us to have you enrolled in the program, because that way if there's a class action lawsuit or a civil liberties lawsuit or a state lawsuit, like what happened with the DACA lawsuit from the state and many states that came together, then the people who are under the program will be the ones that are protected by those lawsuits. So our key message to the community is, again, power, not fear. Seek out the wealth of organizations that we have in the Bay Area to get screened and get a legal consultation to identify what may be the opportunities or challenges to your individual case. Don't let funding or money, the fees for renewal, stop you. We're trying to work with other organizations that do financial literacy, that have funds to help people pay for that. So we're really kind of in full-on processing mode. Of course, there's a lot of concern. Families are asking about what should I do if I get picked up. Obviously, there's like the legal policy war that they're waging on our community, and then there's the narrative, the psychological war that mm-hmm. they're launching in our community. And the most recent example of that is the report in the Examiner or the Chronicle, I can't remember now, about potential raids of 1,500 people in the Bay Area. There's a lot of like conversation among ourselves about how practical and how attainable is really that promise. We're prepared. Our community is informed, and knowledge continues to be power. Mm-hmm. People have rights regardless of your migratory status in this country, and so our primary concern is to get the word out, to get the Know Your Rights information out, and to have the community be informed about the systems that we're scaffolding in our local communities, systems of protection, systems of engagement, and systems of resistance.
That is Larisa Dugan Cuadra. She's Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center. We're also joined today by Vanessa Velasco, a TPS recipient from El Salvador who lives with her family in Brentwood, and Laura Melgarejo, a DACA recipient and civic engagement organizer with PODER, People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights. And today we are talking about immigration. If you heard the speech last night in which Trump equated immigrants, including Dreamers, with terrorists and gang members, we'd love to hear from you. What did you think? If you are an immigrant, how is the discourse and the politics affecting you right now? How has your community been affected by this? I mean, we are seeing deportations happening in this country. Families are being torn apart. People who've been here for decades are being deported to places they don't know. We are hearing about ICE arresting people when they drop their kids off at school or when people go in for their ICE appointments. So there's lots of moving parts right now, and we'd love to hear from you on this. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And also, just what do you think about the aggressive rhetoric? I mentioned at the top of the show that a judge said he will not ignore what he used the word vicious comments from Donald Trump and what Trump is saying about Latinos as he considers the administration's decision to end DACA. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on Facebook or Twitter. Let's talk a little bit about where things are right now, because there are moving parts. Laura, you are a DACA recipient, and we're expecting more decisions about Trump's decision to end DACA. But where does it stand right now?
So right now, students who have a DACA or are recipients of DACA and already expire or will expire in the next 6 months or prior that, they need to go and seek out legal support. A lot of organizations are providing free consultations and helping with all the applications. So again, if you are a DACA recipient and your work permit already expired, you can go and seek out legal support, or if your work permit is about to expire within the next 6 months. Because as of right now, we have a window open for applicants to be able to go and renew, but we don't know how long that's going to be. And especially given the position from the federal government, we don't know what's the future of DACA. So we're asking all our recipient DACA-mented folks to look for a trusted community-based organization in which they can go and renew their DACA and bring all the supporting documents that they might need, so that they're protected in the case that in the future there are potential, if in the future we have a potential remedy or a potential path for citizenship, they're already protected within the program to be able to solicit something else in the future if that's the case.
What do you think about the politics around this? At first, the Senator Chuck Schumer said, we'll give Trump money for a wall if we can extend DACA and ensure that these young people do not have to live in fear. What are your thoughts about the politics around it?
I think the safety of our community is non-negotiable, and I think that it's all of us or none of us. Not just DACA recipients, but TPS holders, and all our about almost 11 million undocumented individuals who live in the country should have a path or a legal remedy. I understand why sometimes the narrative is like that, that only the good immigrants, and I said this in quotation marks, deserve to be here. But in reality, all working families should have an opportunity to stay, the ones that are already here, to stay here and to continue to survive and thrive in a country that, you know, in the first place when they came here, have nothing. And many of them have built their own businesses, have their homeowners, and have made a life in the United States. And I do think that it's all of us and none of us. That's my personal position.
Larissa, what would you add specifically about DACA and the current status? What are you hearing from DACA recipients?
Well, I think the DACA recipients are incredibly resilient and powerful youth. It's a shame that the current leadership of this nation doesn't see the potential of this population. In fact, they're so well equipped. They're multilingual, multicultural, transnational peoples. They want it so bad. We have, countless examples of outstanding dreamers in this nation, and there's so many that stories that don't get told. We feel that, like Laura said, we have to first and foremost respond to the immediate. We're operating on a day-to-day basis because literally every week there's something new coming. Mm-hmm. It's either coming through the hate speech, or it's coming through shifts in policies in the immigration courts, or it's coming with like the ongoing kind of like harassment from politicians on all fronts, really bargaining on people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so we see ACLUs play an incredible role. Even many states have taken steps forward in terms of filing lawsuits. The lawsuit by many states is what has created this window of time because of a recent ruling in the federal court, Ninth Circuit, I believe it was, that essentially ruled that basically the president cannot terminate, DACA. And so there was a moratorium placed on the sunsetting of the program. And so for that reason, we're really busy and engaged in getting youth enrolled or beneficiaries enrolled. But we have many avenues. What we cannot do is give up our power and think that the Congress or that the President of the United States alone are going to achieve the things that we wanted. Everything that the Dreamers got DACA as a result of their struggle. Mm-hmm. So nothing has ever been handed to us. We know how to work in that way because that's how we've always had to work. We know we're in the right side of people and history. We know that migration is a human right. We know that it's not a criminal offense. It's an administrative offense, if anything, if you did enter a country without documents. But all countries are obligated internationally to afford the right to a credible fear interview and to a whole series of administrative processes that would ultimately determine if somebody should be protected by any nation, not just the United States or not. And the fact is that the United States immigration system is broken. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely broken. It does not respond to the global reality in which we all exist. And ultimately, there's incredible ironies, because when you think about corporations being able to go to our countries of origin and set up sweatshops where they exploit child labor, that ultimately is in many cases the reason why young people are being forced to migrate, because they don't have access to education and they don't experience safety, much less opportunities for their future. Many of these families have been divided over the last three, 4 decades because of the wars in Central America for us Central Americans. And Mexico has also felt the repercussions of the militaristic interventions of the U.S. in our region. So there's deep-rooted causes for migration. Mm-hmm. We're not aliens. We didn't drop from Mars. We're humans. We're part of the Americas, part of this continent. We are neighbors of the United States. We're global neighbors and citizens, and, you know, we have to kind of expand the conversation to not just have it be like within, we kind of ourselves, our dialogue gets caught up in these invisible walls. And I just want to take the opportunity to say that the media has also been really incorrect in how they've been reporting the Dreamer story, because they keep saying that the Dreamers are illegal youth in this country. The Dreamers are not illegally in this country. They're currently in this country with the protection of the Deferred Action Program for Childhood Arrivals. So that in itself feeds into this kind of anti-immigrant narrative. Even NPR has been kind of, you know, echoing that kind of narrative and saying illegal immigrants, and we're really tired of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about children, we're talking about families, we're talking about humans, the people who babysit your child, the person, like Vanessa said, that makes your burrito at your favorite taqueria in the mission, the person who cleans up the hotel room that all the, you know, big corporations come to the conferences in San Francisco for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll stop there and let my colleagues jump in.
Yeah, I'd love to ask you more about media after the break. That is Larisa Dugan Cuadra. She's executive director of the Central American Resource Center. We're also joined by Vanessa Velasco, a TPS recipient from El Salvador, temporary protected status. She lives with her family in Brentwood. And Laura Melgarejo is a DACA recipient and civic engagement organizer with People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights. Today we are talking about immigration. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with investigative reporter David K. Johnston about his new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Friday, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about Afghanistan and other issues. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about immigration with a roundtable of guests. Vanessa Velasco is a TPS recipient from El Salvador. That is temporary protected status. We're also joined by Laura Melgarejo, a DACA recipient and civic engagement organizer with People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights. And Larisa Dugan Cuadra is executive director of the Central American Resource Center. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. You know, I just wanted to say, you know, it's really a fantasy to separate justice from immigration. In other words, we have had so many coups and interventions and overthrows. I mean, the history is just filled with, every time a country starts to make a little progress or start to use their own resources through the School of the Americas and the CIA, we've had our people go in. And most recently was, you know, Hillary Clinton and Obama, who were responsible for putting the Contras into government in Honduras. The number one immigrant coming across the border are people from Honduras. And the same with Europe, and it's the same people, Obama and Clinton. You know, when they overthrew Libya, the number one immigrants coming into Europe, many dying in the boats, are from Libya. Now, I'm not saying for Trump, but we have a system where we essentially don't have a choice, you know, between candidates who support this, and all they want to talk about is immigration. But if you have no justice, you're not going to have any peace, and, you know, that's just the same principle that works on our streets. I'll take a response on the air. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Because we have an hour to talk about these issues, we can talk about U.S. foreign policy, about trade deals. There's a great documentary, Harvest of Empire, by Juan Gonzalez, who looks at countries in Central and South America and specifically talks about the United States' role in those countries. You brought this up earlier, Larisa, but how would you respond to this comment?
Well, I got flesh in the game, as they say. I'm Nicaraguan, and I came to the U.S. in 89 at the tail end of the military intervention by the U.S. Through support of the Contras, you know, Contra Sandinista Revolution or war. In any case, at that time, El Salvador was also experiencing a bloody civil war funded by the U.S., as was Guatemala. And I've later come to learn in my life that Honduras has consistently had a resistance movement that we just has been so repressed that often we don't even hear about it. And I think we've heard about it more recently with the coup of Zelaya and this past Saturday, the the inauguration of the president who basically violated the national constitution, which only allows for one term. Yes, I mean, the U.S. continues to intervene in the region. You know, a lot of the economic foreign aid comes from USAID. It comes with many conditions. We've had the opportunity at Carecen. We do transnational advocacy, and we actually do meet with our U.S. embassies in the region and hear what they say they're investing in terms of safety and economic development. And I can tell you we're spending billions and billions of dollars in the region. And one of the things that we've consistently asked for is to have these investments show impact, not just output. Because you tell me you created 1,000 jobs at a sweatshop, but the minute the workers complained about the working conditions, they get fired with no recourse because there's 200 people outside waiting for the job. And so is that really a good investment of U.S. dollars? And so the questions that we've been pushing is, are the economic development funds in the region yielding higher incomes for families, long-term employment, higher levels of education for their children, you know, increased health, the same kind of indicators that we want to see in the United States, and the same things that we struggle with locally, because we still know that urban cities still have major inequity gaps in terms of economics, education, and so on, based on your race and your place. On the other front, the U.S. continues to invest billions of dollars in militarization of our nations. And instead of doing work that's really centered around health, economic growth, and overall, you know, education for our nations, it's really centered about around repression and centered around militarizing. That seems to be the only solution this government can think of as a way to promote health, peace, and well-being. You know, in El Salvador and Honduras, they're right now two of the most violent nations in the world. They are not in active war. And it's a shame because for us, we know that this is a direct repercussion. This is the backlash or the back whip or whatever, whiplash of those interventions and of nations that have been exploited for our resources, our not only our physical natural resources, but our human resources. And just consistently, like, exploited. And then somehow we're supposed to, like, kind of get up from our knees and fix the, our own nations. It's just, it's ludicrous. It's sad. There's a level of conditionality by the U.S. And I'll give you just one of the greatest hypocrisies recently is that the U.S. said, okay, we have the plan for the Alliance for Prosperity for the Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, because of, as a result of the unaccompanied children's crisis publicized in 2014. And they say, okay, we want to see governability, we want to see transparency and democracy. And that was one of the conditions for the economic development aid that's supposed to stem migration. Yet you know, this past Saturday, a president in Honduras was sworn in who essentially violated the national constitution. So that's what's happening. The people who, weapons is a big business in our nations. Mexico, that's true. As much as the Mexican government wants to deny that their country is impacted and deeply afflicted by violence, we know that is a fact because we talk to the children and the families who come through our doors seeking legal support. And no child can make up the stories that we, that our attorneys and our paralegals have to hear. The severe level and degree of ongoing human rights violations that our people have to endure in our countries of origin, on the journey of migration and upon arrival to the U.S., where our communities detained and militarized, detention centers that in every possible way violate any kind of form of human dignity and right.
Vanessa, you're a TPS recipient from El Salvador. What would you add?
Yeah, it's like for us, one of the other thing that I just want to make a point on it is when the DHA's current secretary took the decision to end the TPS for Salvadorian, she admitted that they just took the decision based on the earthquake that happened in 2001 that will be recovered. But that is not true. Our country, El Salvador, currently has a house crisis. There is not enough. And she even said that they have to find a permanent solution for TPS recipients because our country is not ready to receive. And these things are they are not ready for receiving for all the things that they say. We don't have a government. We have a lot of corruption. You can see right now in our country there are three presidents that are being persecuted because they did those all illegal acts and things. It's they know we as a TPS, it's not safe for us to come back. Another thing, our kids, USA citizen kid, and they just put a travel advisor for the country, advisory USA citizen. They will travel at their own risk. That's what can that tell you?
U.S. citizens travel at your own risk if you go to El Salvador.
Yes.
What is it like for people, young and old, or children and adults, I should say, who are sent back to El Salvador? What happens?
Well, as tells or thing that we can hear programs from people that is being deported to El Salvador, it's really hard for them to integrate to a society because there is this stigma about people who's been deported, you were deported because you did something wrong, so the people put a mark on them, and it's really hard after years. And even there is people that is prepared, they are bilingual, they have skills and things. It's really hard how do they have to struggle in More, the emotional charge that they have because they were, most of these people leave families behind in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and have to, it's true, you were sent to our country, but our country doesn't feel like our country anymore. You are not well received.
Last night, Trump was talking about how people can bring all of their family members to the United States, which is not true. We have a question from a caller who could not stay on the line, and she wanted to know, just so we can get this on the record, because there's a lot of misinformation and lies being told about what is allowed and what is not allowed, what's legal and what's not legal. Can you talk, Vanessa, about what you endured, why you decided to come, what the difficulties were? Could you call your family in El Salvador and say, come to the United States? I mean, that's exactly what he said last night.
No, of course not.
Right.
That is not true. It's if you are a permanent a USA citizen, you can pay sponsorship, but if you have to fill an application, and that is you have to qualify for it, you have to go through medical checks, there are processes that take years in order to have the petition for your kid or your spouse or your parents. That's it. Spouse, kids, minor children, or parents, no uncles, cousins, and you can bring all the family, even your dog. That's not true. And for us, we arrived at the United States in 2000, and the gangs start to take over. The deportees start to take over. It's suddenly from night to day. you start to see these people, you know, taking, you know, certain parts of the cities and, you know, the level of danger. You even have to ask permission to cross one block to another. And the opportunity, my husband is a TPS beneficiary, and the same thing. We don't have the kind of opportunity. We have the willing to you know, to war, to succeed and everything, but the things, they were not adding up. And that's how why we took the decision to come to the United States and look for our American dream.
Can I also say, my mother's Nicaraguense, and I'm U.S. citizen, so I'm a mixed status child, like, I have brothers that are not U.S. citizens. I petitioned my mother when I was 18 years old, and it took 20-something years to even get a response. I mean, I got there like, yeah, we got your petition, and then it just sat there for decades, literally. and just so everybody knows, my mom declined. So she's happy living in Nicaragua, even though there's challenges and struggles in our own countries. But my mom, basically, after coming to the U.S., finally getting a visa, a tourist visa, came and just realized that this country was not the place for her because of the level of racial tension and stigma around your migratory status that she experienced. So it is a myth that any one of us who's a U.S. citizen can just ask for our families to come and that they're going to be able to pack their bags the next day and make it over here. If I petition for my brothers, the likelihood of that petition being denied is like 95% because they're now older. So there's very, even if you ask for a minor sibling, it could take 15, 20 years. And so this is like, again, this is what we talk about when we talk about a broken system. It should not take an 18-year-old 20 years to be reunited with their parent. And so my mom missed my high school graduation. My mom missed my child's birth. My mom missed all the milestones that most parents, you know, hoped that they were going to be there with their child. She wasn't at my marriage. Basically, all the important things that have happened in my life, my mom has not been a part of. And so for me to remain connected and rooted with my family, fortunately, I'm a U.S. citizen, so I can travel home and sustain my roots and my ties to my family, my siblings, my mother. But that's not the case for a lot of my hermanas and sisters and brothers who are also undocumented, who are equally separated from their parents, and they don't even have the option to ever go back to their countries of origin to maybe bury their grandparent or, you know, be at the birth of their niece or nephew. So, you know, that there's all this bureaucracy around people's lives, but at the end of the day, what it really means is our families are separated, and we actually create, like, we choose our families in the U.S. And I want to say this, I think there's more good people in this nation than people who just need to be more educated. But the fact is that it's difficult. It's difficult when you're an 18 or a 16 or a 17-year-old. When Donald Trump yesterday said that the unaccompanied children that came to this country were MS-13 gang members. The children who were brave enough to either get on a train or subject themselves to sexual assault, trafficking, and all forms of violence were fleeing violence. And so it is profoundly offensive the more I think about it. And you know, politicians, both the Democrats and the Republicans, are playing politics with people's lives. Mm-hmm. And it's just a shame, and it's a shame that this nation's government is truly not reflecting the values of the people that they're supposed to represent.
Laura, would you like to talk a little bit about your story?
Sure. So I was born and raised in the state of Michoacán in Mexico, and just talking about root causes of immigration and like the pull and push factors. We left because I grew up in a farm, and for years and generations, we sustained our families out of cultivating corn and veggies and all these things. And when NAFTA happened, it had a devastating effect on farmers like my family. So my father decided to, we couldn't compete with the market, and he decided to look for opportunities of work outside of my state. And it was very difficult for a farmer to find a job in another areas within my own country. You know, and then he had family members who were already in the U.S., and they thought that it was going to be a better opportunity for my whole family to, you know, migrate to the north and have better opportunities, not just of to go to school or educational opportunities, but also to be in a place where we're going to be safe. Michoacán in Mexico is one of the states that has the highest prevalence of violence because of organized crime. We have a lot of the cultivos and a lot of the people, like organized crime people within our own state. That's like the home of the organized crime within Mexico. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, all this, like the impact the NAFTA had in small farms, like my family, plus the organized crime in our country, all these factors kind of led to my family to decide to come to the U.S.
Can you elaborate on that? Because we hear about NAFTA, there are reports coming out, but I think it's really important, since you have personal experience with it, to talk about how that affected your family and other people in your community.
Yeah, so like I said, I grew up in a farm, and most of the families around the area within my country, within the state, we survive out of, you know, growing and selling our corn to the big markets in the state of Michoacán. But when NAFTA and the treaty happened, a lot of farmers like my family couldn't compete with the exports and imports of the U.S., and we didn't have the infrastructure. You know, our process of growing our corn, it's on a calendar. It's not like on a lab where you produce it tonight and then tomorrow it's going to be ready. No, we work within the calendar year. You have to first cultivate. I mean, all these things on the process of farming. And unfortunately, like I said, for generations, that's how we sustain ourselves. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, and all my uncles and cousins, that was a way of living for us, cultivating our own lands and being able to sell our corn to the big markets. But that was not the case after NAFTA. That was not that infrastructure wasn't in place for families like my family to be able to compete with the market and to be able to sustain ourselves.
Did the Mexican government create any sort of programs to help your family and others after NAFTA?
No, we didn't have any support, unfortunately, from my own government to be able to sustain families like in situations like my family. And that still continue the case, as Larissa was saying before, because of the promises of, you know, industry and corporations coming into our country, mm-hmm. promising jobs and promising prosperity for families. But the reality is that our workers back home, and the maquiladoras mm-hmm. specifically, get no access to quality health care, have no access to overpay, especially for women. We know that they're always sexually harassed at the workplace. How many killings happen in Tijuana just because of women workers getting out of the work at the nighttime, going home and being kidnapped and raped on their way home? So, it's very unfortunately to know that even my own country was not able to provide for my own people.
And you're a DACA recipient. How is the rest of your family doing right now?
My family are okay, and I'd rather not talk about them just for safety reasons, but they're like many other families in the U.S., they're under a lot of fear, but they know that we have a whole community. San Francisco is we're a different city compared to, and we're very blessed and privileged to be in a county that it's going to be responding to the needs of our immigrant families, but they're going to be okay.
We have just a couple minutes left. Final thoughts. What do you think is most effective for people who want to support immigrants and you all and the communities that you work with? Larissa?
If we have any question about immigrant rights being linked to all other civil rights in this nation, then I think that's the number one request, is to say, you know, this is no different than the civil rights movement. This is no different than, like, all the things that we've struggled for in this nation in terms of abolishing slavery. There's still a lot of work to be done for the Native communities, but we're part of, like, the struggles in the landscape of this nation, we're equal members of this nation. We contribute equally. And two, that, you know, get engaged. There are so many ways of helping. For organizations like Caresen, just to be really honest, the level of work that we're having to put out exceeds our existing resources, so we definitely welcome contributions for our work. We have two pools of funding support that we're asking for. One is a direct fund for beneficiaries to help young people pay for the renewal fees for emergency needs and so on. That's the Vinicio Fund at Caresen. And then you can make a general donation to our organization that will help us sustain our work. Also, just, you know, go to our website, help us spread the word. We have brochures and information on our website about people's rights. We also have information about our San Francisco Rapid Response Network, which is intended to verify reports of raids in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of helpful information. Have conversations with our community. Don't make assumptions, and also don't be patronizing. and just also thank you. You know, thank you to the Bay Area community, because in hard times we've you know shown our best, mm-hmm. and we've shown that we are a leader in the nation in terms of like the true values of this country. Because it's not just about saying it, but it's also about putting your money where your mouth is. And I think that locally in the Bay Area region, our elected officials are working on that. And then also just the faith community, everybody else, the students, everyone else, like, thank you for your support and engagement. It does make a big difference to our community.
Larisa Dugan-Cuadra is Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center. Laura Melgarejo is a DACA recipient and civic engagement organizer with People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights. And Vanessa Velasco is a TPS Temporary Protected Status recipient from El Salvador who lives with her family in Brentwood. Larisa, Laura, and Vanessa, thank you all so much for coming in. Thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, investigative reporter David K. Johnston will be in studio to talk about his new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you missed any of our past shows, how poverty became a crime in the United States, the fight to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or documenting the erosion of abortion and reproductive rights, you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also podcast our show. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.